Our Hebrew scripture reading comes from the book of 1 Kings, and it is happens soon after Solomon, as a young man, is chosen and inaugurated through a little bit of political intrigue that we don't need to go into right now. Much of the book of Kings, the books of Kings, is full of Machiavellian political intrigue. It definitely shows all the kings with feet of clay. But this is a place where wisdom, or where Solomon asks God not for wealth, not for power, but for wisdom.
The king went to Gibeon, the most prestigious of the local shrines, to worship. He sacrificed 1,000 whole burnt offerings on that altar. That night, there in Gibeon, God appeared to Solomon in a dream. God said, "What can I give you? Ask." Solomon said, "You were extravagantly generous in love with David, my father, and he lived faithfully in your presence. His relationships were just and his heart right. And you have persisted in this great and generous love by giving him, and this very day, a son to sit on his throne. And now here I am, God, my God, you have made me your servant, ruler of the kingdom in place of David, my father. I'm too young for this, a mere child. I don't know the ropes, hardly know the ins and outs of this job. And here I am, set down in the middle of the people you've chosen, a great people, far too many to ever count. Here's what I request. Give me wisdom, a God-listening heart, so I can lead your people well, discerning the difference between good and evil. For who on their own is capable of leading your glorious people?" God, the master, was delighted with Solomon's response. And God said to him, "Because you have asked for this and haven't grasped after a long life or riches or the doom of your enemies, but you have asked for the ability to lead and govern well, I'll give you what you've asked for. I'm giving you a wise and mature heart. There's never been one like you before, and there'll be no one after. As a bonus, I'm giving you both the wealth and glory you didn't ask for. There's not a king anywhere who will come up to your mark. And if you stay on course, keeping your eye on the life map and the God signs in your father David did, I will give you a long life." Solomon woke up. What a dream! He returned to Jerusalem, took his place before the chest of the covenant of God, and worshiped by sacrificing whole burnt offerings and peace offerings. Then he laid out a banquet for everyone in his service.
Thank you, Christine. The translation we used today was the Message translation / paraphrase by Eugene Peterson, who died last week. So a wonderful Christian voice has been stilled. The gospel reading comes from Luke's gospel, the 7th chapter. Jesus is meeting resistance from the religious authorities. And he makes this comparison. "John the Baptist has come, eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Nevertheless, wisdom is vindicated by all her children." There's a dumb old pastor story of a pastor who was at an administrative board meeting and was praying hard, and God said, "I hear your prayers, my son. What can I grant you?" And the pastor says, "Oh, I could ask for power. I could ask for money. I could ask for wisdom, like Solomon. Yeah, Lord, grant me wisdom. And suddenly a glow is sparkling around the pastor, and everyone around him goes, oh, tell us something wise, pastor. And he goes, oh, I should have asked for the money. Okay. Wisdom is an attribute of God and a precious treasure for human beings throughout the Bible. Wisdom is almost always lifted up as one of the highest of human journeys, human strivings. And in our reading today, King Solomon, when in a dream, God asks him, what do you want, man? He asks not for wealth, not for power, not for long life, not for his enemies to be smited, but wisdom. And God is pleased with the request and throws in wealth and power as a bonus for Solomon. Now, if one reads the rest of the book of 1 Kings, you might wonder how well he used that God-given wisdom. But that's another sermon for another time. But I want you to know that wisdom is important, an important concept in Scripture. But it, frankly, it's kind of all over the place in how it's defined or how it's treated. So one might ask, what is wisdom according to the Bible? Now, there's a whole set of literature in the Bible called, are you ready for it? Wisdom literature. Very imaginative, I know. And this is readings that look at the big questions of life, the universe, and everything. There is a Hebrew tradition that's probably not historically accurate that claims that Solomon, being known for being wise, wrote much of the wisdom literature in the Bible, just as David, the musician, is credited with most of the Psalms, and Moses, the lawgiver, is credited with most of the Torah. The first five books of the Bible, probably not including the parts where he died and was buried. He must have had a secretary for that or something. We don't know. Now, some Hebrew wisdom tradition is pretty orthodox and pedantic, to use a fancy scholastic term. Orthodox Hebrew wisdom pictures a very neat universe, a morally balanced universe where bad people are foolish and ignore God's laws and fail at everything, while good people always are wise and always follow God's will and way and do very well. Thank you very much. In the book of Proverbs, you can read very pithy sayings like, the plans of the righteous are just, but the advice of the wicked is deceitful. Or, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. They're just kind of, Benjamin Franklin used to do little sayings like that was in Poor Richard's Almanac, right? Yeah, so, yeah, kind of just pithy little aphorisms. Thank you, that's the word we want. Some of the Psalms are considered wisdom Psalms. Psalm 1, is one most people get to before they fall asleep, is one that is a wisdom Psalm. Psalm 10 asks the existential question, why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? We echo that. Jesus shares a wisdom Psalm when he says, my God, why have you forgotten me? Psalm 37, a little more orthodox, seems to respond with conventional parental advice. It's in Psalm 37, do not fret because of the wicked, do not be envious of wrongdoers, for they shall soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. So when someone says, wait a minute, if God is just, how come these really rotten people are doing really, really, really well? And the answer is like, well, it just looks like it. You wait. By next week, they'll all fall down and wither. And that's great advice as long as it's working. But we also look around, as many biblical writers looked around and saw that, wow, it's not that neat a universe. really, really nice, wonderful, God-fearing, God-following people have terrible lives. And people who are really, really dreadful are doing great. What's the deal? So there are also some other wisdom books in the Bible that aren't quite so orthodox, or if they're orthodox, they're not quite so neat. There's the book of Job. In the book of Job, you have a suffering mortal who is shaking his angry fist at God, saying, "You are unjust. I want to take you to court, but I can't because there's no one big enough to be judge against you. Just this whole thing is wrong." And it says that wisdom and knowledge are good, but they are so hidden and so precious and are nearly impossible to find. So it's impossible to make sense of a universe where innocent people suffer. There's a book called Ecclesiastes, or in the Hebrew, Koheleth, which cynically posits that there is nothing new under the sun. Everything that went around comes back around, and we just are on this life of reruns. Yes, sir?
Of course, this was said well before technology progressed to this point.
This was before there was a fast technology. But we can also see, when we see technology change, the way we use it is just as stupid as ever. Einstein very famously said, after the invention of the atomic bomb, very new technology, he said, "Now everything is new except human foolishness." So in that sense, everything stays the same. He says that striving too hard for anything, whether it is beauty or health or power or pleasure or even wisdom, is folly and chasing after wind. In the King James is vanity, all is vanity, and chasing after wind. And even more unexpected in the wisdom tradition is a wisdom book called Song of Songs, which I shared at your wedding a few weeks ago, is a breathlessly erotic love poem. I'll just read an R-rated chunk here. Your lips distill nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your garments is like the scent of Lebanon. Your channel is an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon. Yeah. So the Hebrew tradition, when it looks at all these radically different ways of looking at wisdom, kind of explain it by saying, well, Solomon, who wrote all of these in the tradition, wrote Song of Solomon or Song of Songs when he was a strapping young man, and Proverbs as a mature king, and Ecclesiastes when he was old and bitter and cynical, perhaps. But one of the strangest parts in the wisdom literature in the Hebrew scriptures is in the book of Proverbs, in chapter 8, where wisdom isn't just a thing to strive after, but actually is a person. Wisdom is personified as a woman named Lady Wisdom. Not very imaginative, I know. Or Dom Wisdom. It's Chochma in the Hebrew, or Sophia in the Greek. And she writes this in the book of Proverbs, this Lady Wisdom. "The Lord created me at the beginning of God's work, the first of God's acts of long ago. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginnings of the earth. When God established the heavens, I was there. When God drew a circle on the face of the deep, when God made firm the skies above, when God established the fountains of the deep, when God assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress his command, when God marked out the foundations of the earth, there I was beside God, like a master worker, and I was daily God's delight. Rejoicing before the Lord always, rejoicing in this inhabited world and delighting in the human race." Wisdom as a female astrophysicist slash engineer is kind of neat. Now, it was this wisdom tradition, wisdom personified, wisdom, word, knowledge, as a being or as an aspect of God that the Gospel of John echoes when John's Gospel echoes this language saying, in the beginning was the Word. Word, logos, and Sophia are very related philosophically. Nothing came into being without the Word. There I was at the beginning with God. And it also seems that this is the tradition that Jesus was tapping into when he talked about this strange saying, wisdom is vindicated by all her children. Jesus is connecting to that personified Lady Wisdom. Wisdom is vindicated by all her children. In the precise time that the situation he was saying this in was, he was saying that God's wisdom doesn't always look like we expect, but it is recognized by its results, by its fruit, by its children. Jesus here is saying that both he and John the Baptist are both wisdom's children, but neither are recognized because they don't look like what we want or expect. Everyone sees John, and they go, or John the Baptist, and they're like, oh, he's crazy, he eats bugs, he's wearing camel's hair, he's out there screaming at the top of his lungs and dunking people in the water. He has a demon, he must be possessed to be that crazy. And Jesus comes being like Mr. Mellow and talking about love and mercy and compassion, and they're like, you hippie freak, you can't be of God. So John the Baptist gets rejected by the authority and the people of his day because he's not driving a Mercedes, he's wearing itchy wool long johns. He called the president a womanizer one time too often and got his head cut off for the trouble. And Jesus was rejected by the authorities and the people for the opposite reason, because he was such a bleeding heart liberal, hanging out with hookers, marching in too many Black Lives Matter marches, eating too much kale, drinking too much locally brewed India Pale Ale. He called the moral majority a bunch of hypocrites a few times too often, and he got crucified for his troubles. Jesus is saying, look at the fruit. Wisdom is vindicated by her children. Jesus is saying that John the Baptist was a child of wisdom because of the many lives he transformed at the shores of the Jordan River. Jesus is a child of wisdom because of the lives he healed and made whole, the words of wisdom and the acts of power that he shared. Wisdom, Sophia, is vindicated by these children no matter the human expectations. It's what is the fruit that they yield. Now, whenever I read the Gospels and I see how Jesus is being rejected by the people and the people in power, especially the religious authorities, I like to think, I would have been different. Maybe. I like to think that if Jesus showed up today, that humanity might treat him different. Howdy. But you know what? Not much has changed. Humanity has not changed. I think we wish human nature were different today, but that we might be more open to God's unexpected movements around us, but you know, we haven't changed. Just as Einstein said about before and after the atomic bomb, human foolishness is a permanent aspect of who we are. We all have our own picture about how we think that God ought to work in the world. We have our own notions of what a man or a woman of God should look like. And if God has the unmitigated gall to work through a person near us that we consider too uptight or too loosey-goosey or too conservative or too punk or too flatlander or too local or too black and white or too feminist or too patriarchal or too this or too that or too whatever, then we're going to be miffed, right? How can God work through someone different than me? Can't be happening. And we will reject them. Jesus said, Sophia, wisdom is vindicated by her children, by acts of love, by compassion, mercy, gentleness, and grace. And conversely, evil is proven by its children, acts of hatred, prejudice, tribalism. We saw it this week again. Just like we saw it a few weeks ago, and a few weeks before that, and a few weeks before that. Mass shootings barely make the news if it's under 3 or 4 people. It's just not news anymore. An angry man with a semi-automatic weapon hardly makes us blink. What does that say about us? We're getting used to violence being the offspring of our national conversation around differences. What does that say about us? Healthy political disagreement is replaced by pipe bombs. Inclusion of people of color, of different religions, genders, sexualities is met with a hail of bullets from semi-automatic weapons. The wisdom tradition says we have a choice. Whose child will we be? Children of wisdom, divine wisdom, or children of human folly? Wisdom of the world, or the wisdom of Christ? And the wisdom of the world says the wisdom of Christ is pretty goofy. Frederick Buechner, one of my favorite theologians, wrote this: if the world is sane, then Jesus is mad as a hatter. And the Last Supper is the mad tea party. The world says, mind your own business, and Jesus says, there is no such thing as your own business. The world says, follow the wisest course and be a success, and Jesus says, follow me and be crucified. The world says, drive carefully, the life you save may be your own, and Jesus says, whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. The world says, get, and Jesus says, give. In terms of the world's sanity, Jesus is crazy as a coot, and anybody who thinks they can follow him without being a little crazy as well is laboring less under a cross than under a delusion. I think Frederick Buechner has it down pretty well, actually. We can follow the wisdom of the world. We can follow the wisdom of Christ. And here's the thing. C.S. Lewis warns us that that's not a one-time decision, but rather that every decision we make, every little decision we make, is like a watershed moment, sending us a little bit toward the wisdom of the world or a little bit more toward the wisdom of Christ. And those actions build upon each other and build upon each other. A life of faith, a life of yes and no, a life of following is a journey. It's not a final destination. Faith is a journey. Martin Marty, who's the editor of the Christian Century magazine, wrote this last week. He said, living a life aligned with Jesus is extremely difficult. We practice and practice trying to get even a few basics right. It's mostly unglamorous as brushing teeth at the bookends of the day or playing scales and arpeggios in endless fashion while learning the piano. I'm thoroughly convinced that nothing resembling expertise exists in the Christian life. I said this before, we are all beginners. How can you become an expert at receiving the totally undeserved mercy of God on a daily basis? What difference would brilliance make for allowing your heart to break more frequently for people who suffer? Exactly what kind of mastery would be necessary to live consistently in unself-serving ways? There's a reason we speak meaningfully of practicing the faith. It's all practice. It's all a journey. Maya Angelou once remarked, "I'm working at trying to be a Christian, and that's serious business. It's not something where you think, oh, I've got it done, I did it all day, hot diggity." I think Maya Angelou is the only person who can say hot diggity without anyone wincing. She writes, "The truth is, all day long you try to do it, you try to be it. And then in the evening, if you're honest and have a little courage, you look at yourself and say, I only blew it 86 times. Not bad. I'm trying to be a Christian." In our Monday Companions class, Living the Questions, we heard an interview with Maya Angelou when she was asked by a person in the audience at a book signing, "Are you a Christian?" And she said, "Are you?" And the woman said, "Why, I certainly am." And Maya Angelou went, "Already?" It's a journey. "My goodness, you're fast," she thought. We have the opportunity every day to make a decision to be a child of God's wisdom or a child of worldly wisdom. A choice for mercy and justice and compassion and love, or a choice for cynicism and power and tribalism and violence. And we'll mess up. And there's grace. And that's all good. We have an opportunity just in the week coming up to do some good stuff. Could you go to the next slide, Bob? There's a Hebrew concept, tikkun. Tikkun olam, which means heal the world, or repair the world, or redeem the world. Our partnering with God in helping fix a broken people and place. I just found this group here in Vermont called Love. I forgot their name. I'll get it and put it on. They're a Facebook group where, when there's some tragedy, like the shooting at the synagogue yesterday, they write letters of love and prayer and support. When there's a mass shooting, when there's a tragedy, when there's pain, they do something nobody does anymore. Write letters with their hand and hand address them and send them out. So these all went to the Tree of Life congregation, the synagogue in Pittsburgh this week. And I'll get their address out. It's such a small thing, but can you imagine getting a letter from somebody in Vermont that says we're praying for you. You're on our minds and you're on our heart. Tikkun olam. What are we doing to repair the breach? Another opportunity we have is to begin collecting for some of the storm-ravaged parts of our country. The United Methodist Volunteers in Mission is going to be working with a Lutheran relief organization and FEMA. Surprising. They're asking for volunteers to go to Saint Croix. In November and December. They pay your way and a $50 stipend each day because they need folk with some talent in carpentry and concrete work and other stuff. We're invited to be a part of that. We can also, if we can't travel to St. Croix or St. Thomas, we can make flood buckets. We can make cleaning buckets, both for our for homes and for people. There's a very quick video on how to assemble one of the buckets, and we'll have a bucket party happening in Shelburne on November 10th. Probably make a few of those.
I believe that is what they're doing, the hygiene
kits. It's the hygiene kits that they're doing in Shelburne. Okay. So we have a list, and we can get a group.
They usually have
all of it there. They just need bodies to help do all that folding. Do you have to wear the red blouse thing?
That's sort of, I think that's probably true.
That's required. Okay. Yeah. Every day we have a choice. To say yes to the sometimes more difficult path of forgiveness, mercy, compassion, inclusion, joy. Or the decision toward hatred and violence, anger, and tribalism. One that draws a line and says, real human beings are here and non-human beings are on the other side of my line. We have that choice every day. So, brothers and sisters, I invite you to continue your journey of faith. I invite you to celebrate that we're all beginners. I invite you to depend not on your own wisdom, but on the wisdom we receive from God. I invite you to become children of God's wisdom, just as Jesus was and John was, and all of us are invited to be. Amen.